Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books in Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by three authors, Apal Jupe, Amy Erica Smith, and Anand Edward Soki, who are authors of The Knowledge Polity, Teaching and Research in the Social Sciences. This is published by Oxford University Press in 2022. And I have to tell you, it's a compelling book. It's an important book. And I was fascinated to be able to read it. And I'm delighted to be able to talk to the three of you about this really interesting research. So I'd like to welcome my guests to the podcast and ask them each to tell us a little bit about themselves and how they came to this project that has been percolating, it seems, for quite some time.
All right. Well, maybe I will start off with the background on how we came to this topic, and then I'll let each of the, by the way, this is Amy Erica. I will start off by talking a little bit about the topic and then go on and talk more about the, I'll let each person introduce themselves and give a little bit about their background. So the impetus for this project came out of a conversation on Facebook back in the days when Facebook, there was a golden era of Facebook in my academic life when people were actually having real conversations on Facebook, which doesn't really seem to be happening so much anymore. But I would say this was probably back, 2015, Paul? 2015, 2016? Something like that we had this conversation on Facebook. This is, you know, before the election, before all of that. We were having, David Samuels, who's a professor at University of Minnesota, a political scientist at University of Minnesota, had done some analysis of his own data at the journal Comparative Political Studies, for which he is an editor, where he was auditing journal submissions and publications and discovered that women were dramatically less likely to submit work to CPS than it seemed like they should based on their representation within the field of political scientists, but that conditional on women submitting, he could not tell that there was any bias against women as far as he could see from the data. So that publications by women were being accepted at the same rate, or submissions by women were being accepted at the same rate as submissions by men, but women were not submitting as many things as they, as it seemed like they should. And Paul and I were on the same Facebook thread and started talking about it. We were just geeking out at this, what could cause this? What could be driving this? And, we immediately start pulling in our all of our different hats and different research perspectives from political behavior research, from social network research, political psychology research. So we start, immediately throwing out a whole bunch of hypotheses and we're like, oh, well, somebody could do a survey about this. Well, obviously it would be Paul and me. If anybody's going to do it, it's going to be me and Paul. And Paul was like, well, let's bring in Anand. And that's the genesis of all of this. So as far as my own personal background, I have my PhD from the University of Pittsburgh in 2005. Anand and I first met I think it was the January of my second year in the PhD program. I went to my first conference. Anand and I were doing a work that was Anand's dissertation was a very similar topic to what would eventually become my own dissertation work. He was a few years ahead of me in the PhD program. So I cold emailed him. I was like, hey, we're doing similar work. You want to get together? And we walked around New Orleans. That is the start of it all. So then I met Paul when did I meet Paul? I think the first time I met him was also at a conference you were my discussant at a conference. I think I was right at the tail end of my PhD program finishing up. Hadn't yet gotten a job. I had just started doing research in religion and politics. Paul was a discussant of mine on a paper, super nice and enthusiastic and helpful and kind. And I was like, oh, well, here's somebody who's like a big name in the field who actually is willing to talk to me and be nice. And then somehow over time, Paul and I like actually struck up, you know, a real, you know, like collaboration and more of a real friendship. I don't know if he would. Anyway, sorry. I was going to make a stupid joke and I can't even come up with it. So that's my story, how I got involved in this. Ended up at teaching at Iowa State University, where I came into it in 2012, and I've been here ever since. Anand, do you want to take it?
Sure. That's right. I remember walking around the French Quarter with Amy Erica, and we were looking for, you know, beignets and coffee, and probably not looking very hard because, you know, it's everywhere. I had a great conversation. I met Paul when I was a sophomore in college. So Paul was my undergrad advisor, and I started working with him when I was still a teenager. And I'm still working with them. So be careful about your co-authors because they stick around. I've known Paul for a very long time, and we've worked on many projects together. And with respect to this particular project, as Amy Erica noted, there were those kind of conversations in the, you know, 2015, 2016, 2017 time that were going on about what could be happening here with, you know, submissions and publications. And I would just also add that, you know, another big kind of point of conversation that was a jumping off point for this project for us was like the work of Thiel and Thelen, looking at these dynamics across, you know, other journals as well. So kind of spurred conversation for us about, well, what is it that could be happening here? What role might things like co-authorship networks play in this process? And we seem like good people to try to figure this out. Then everything kind of started rolling from there, with stoppages, but also kind of like additions and so forth. Just kind of quickly a little bit about me. So I went to The Ohio State University for graduate school. I am now an associate professor of political science at the University of Colorado at Boulder. I've been out here since 2009. And just still hanging around these mountains. So, Paul?
Yeah. So you've heard my connection to these two. And pretty much when I think this is the story of my co-authorship is whenever I find people who are interesting and willing to work hard and have ideas, just grab onto them and try to stick with them as much as possible. Apparently they can't get rid of me. So I'm really fortunate to have been able to meet these two and at various stages in their career, becoming political scientists and to keep working with them. I'm sort of we cover the range of institutions. So Amy Erica at R2, and then Anand at R1, and I'm at a liberal arts college and have been my entire career. So I started at Denison, got my PhD in 97 from WashU at St. Louis, and then went to a couple of liberal arts colleges for short-term contracts, and then ended up at Denison since 1999. I would say that's since the Harry Potter series has been out to date it. It's a long time. Yeah, political scientist and was the only kind of quant guy. So feeling kind of isolated. Also, just I do a lot of research, which isn't all that common in liberal arts college faculty. And so actually, I started being interested in looking at the discipline as an object of study a little bit earlier than this project. I did a study of a survey of political scientists asking about their reviewing practices, because I was doing tons. And it just felt like no one had any idea what was normative. And I thought, hey, if we're going to reward this, or really like selfishly, if I'm going to get rewarded for this, I want to, you know, be able to compare it to something. So started with that survey, and then from there, you know, I mean, there's just all kinds of really super interesting questions to start asking. And so it was on my radar screen, and always looking for sort of more of these opportunities, like what's next, when that Facebook conversation happened in the golden age of academic Facebook, which was brief. So yeah.
Thank you for all introducing yourselves and talking about the sort of enjoyable connections that lead to collaborations and co-authorships. I myself have enjoyed quite a few of those, and they can be fortuitous and sort of random. Also, my latest book is coming out of a Twitter conversation. So I wanted to ask you, Paul, as you sort of noted, you sort of had been looking at political science, the discipline, as a subject for study. And the book that you all have produced is not just political science, it is broadly social science, but you are looking specifically at political scientists and sociologists for a lot of the research. But it's a complicated sort of study of political science in multiple sort of directions and intersections. Can I ask you all to sort of lay out the parameters of what you decided to look at? And to some degree, you also connect it to the fact that the pandemic started and the George Floyd protests and the Me Too movement all kind of had capacities in a little bit of framing what you were doing. So I just want listeners to understand what the study was before we get into what you found.
Paul, would you like to take it?
Yeah, sure. So this is a warning to authors that they should produce their books more quickly, because events overtake you and then you have to deal with them. So, you know, we had to deal with the pandemic, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We started with political scientists, and, you know, no one, well, APSA was unwilling to share an email list with us. And so we had to go gather our own. And so we started, and this was kind of fortuitous too. We started with a list of APSA member departments. And so that's not every department, but it's pretty close. And we randomly selected half of those. And then, you know, ourselves and got some students to help us gather all the emails from the websites. And eventually we decided that we wanted to include sociology. And so we stuck with the same institutions. And so they don't always have a sociology department, and sometimes it's Socianth, and sometimes it's all kinds of things, all kinds of different names. Sometimes they add criminology in there. Anyway, so we gathered all of those folks. So they're paired with the political science departments at particular universities. So in that way, hierarchically structured, and they're comparable because they're coming from the same institutions. So we started there and surveyed them. And this was in 2017, a little bit later for the sociologists. But then, you know, I mean, just as we got going and just got excited and realized we needed to get some additional evidence. And so we added lifetime scores. So we gathered that from various sources, initially from Google Scholar, and that wasn't really sufficient. And so we went to Web of Science and gathered those. We gathered Twitter data because we asked people for their Twitter handles, and some had that. We went digging for personal web pages. I mean, so we really tried to get a comprehensive sense of kind of what their public presence was. I think that captures it. Actually, we tried to get economists involved in this too. And holy cow, are they stingy with their time. I mean, the response rate was so bad that we just couldn't even use it. So we got data from like 75 economists or something compared to 900 sociologists and 800 political scientists. So,
wow. Anyway. Economists don't want to take surveys. Yeah. Got it.
They weren't getting paid. So,
yeah. So when we had economists at some point say, well, you can't really count this as a survey of the social sciences unless you include economists. And we're like, well, we tried.
And so in looking at the political scientists and sociologists and the 75 economists who responded, what were you asking them about? Because the thrust of the research is really about sort of your experience as an academic and how, how being white or male or non-white or female has potentially influenced how you experience your life as a political scientist, as a sociologist, and where some of the differences are for those who are sort of cis white male versus everybody else, perhaps. Can you explain a little bit? I mean, you talk a lot about gender, which has also been fairly significantly studied in the academy. And then you also talk about how you were trying to get at some of the data around race and ethnicity. And that was a little bit harder to tease out as well. So I'd like to sort of lay out some of the questions and points that you were trying to get at with regard to your surveys of all these social scientists.
Okay. I can take the question about race and gender. So I would say that we came at it with, I guess you can think of it as maybe thinking about it in that sort of an empiricist framework, we could think of it in terms of dependent variables and theoretical approaches, or key sort of theoretically relevant independent variables, and then also demographic independent variables that we were interested in. The dependent variables that we were interested in, the things that we were interested in explaining, was basically productivity. So when Paul was talking about, say, lifetime scores, he meant lifetime sort of publications, things that are documented in Google Scholar and such. Our key independent variables that we were really interested in, and this came out of, intense social discussion within the academy, as well as within society more broadly, about inequalities, that was really, I think, in the mid-2010s, ramping up and had become really very relevant in a lot of society, and only became more relevant during the Trump years. Which may be to come again. Anyway, I would say one of the things that became evident really quickly to me as I began doing this research, and also this was for me, like for Paul, this was not my only foray into trying to examine academia. I got involved in a project on syllabi as well. I had several publications related to gender representation on syllabi and how students respond to gender representation on syllabi. It's kind of a separate parallel line of research that helped me think these things through. Anyway, one thing that became clear really fast was that most published research is looking at gender, and there's just not a lot of public published research or ongoing research in political science looking at, or in sociology looking at academia and race. And I think there are technological and sort of like empirical reasons for this. And then there are probably sort of larger sort of social prejudices and biases kinds of reasons for this. The technical reasons for it is there are more women in these fields than there are faculty of color. It's easier to study large minorities than it is to study small minorities quantitatively. And in gender in particular has is relatively easy to study because names are so strongly gendered. First names are so strongly gendered in American society that you can tell a lot about, you can guess somebody's gender with pretty strong accuracy most of the time based on their first name, whereas you can't, I mean, first name is a much weaker signal of race and ethnicity. So name data is an important reason that people are often studying gender and not other issues. And then I think from sort of a more of a sociological perspective of why are people doing this, I think a lot of the people who've been spearheading the research on gender in both political science and sociology have been women, often white women. And it tends to be the minoritized group that will do this research. So we have, because of the dramatic underrepresentation of faculty of color in political science, I think in sociology, I think we have had lower representation of that research. So anyway, we thought that a survey would be a great way to get at this, and most people don't have survey data. So a survey enables us to address all sorts of issues related to gender identity and race that other researchers haven't been able to get at. In terms of our sort of theoretical approaches, we took an approach that was focused on social networks, on personality, and on institutions. So we looked at three big buckets of kind of explanatory factors that could help us understand how gender and race are playing out in levels of productivity. Paul, would you like to add anything there with respect to those big buckets?
Well, I mean, we all study political behavior, political participation, right? And like, this is the model. I mean, so it felt so natural and for us to take up those things that we're really strongly borrowing, I think, from political science from our own political science research to go down these paths.
And I would add too that, you know, the other things that, in addition to kind of those three big categories, you know, we also really wanted to take the opportunity to do things like document workflow for people, right? So we wanted to understand, if you take a typical piece that you're working on, right, or project, or however you want to think about it, what are the many different stages of that project, right, from beginning to end? So we wanted to like get data that we could actually kind of bring to a conversation that looks at what a typical project's lifespan is, you know, because we saw all kinds of chatter about that, but we didn't really think that there was a way to quantify and compare those experiences easily if we didn't kind of do something with this. In addition, we wanted to really understand something about kind of people's orientations towards all of these different processes that we're involved with too, right? So yes, there's these kind of big factors with, you know, networks, personality, and institutions. We're focused on those, but we also wanted to collect information on, okay, what are people's feelings about the review process, right? Like what kinds of anxieties, if you will, do people have about that process, which is really a big part of, you know, kind of the ways that we are, you know, evaluated and promoted and something that we're called to do as part of this knowledge polity, right? And we'll get to that, I think, in terms of the way that we're thinking about academe. But that was also some of the information that we really wanted to get in our study that we administered to political scientists and sociologists.
And I do want to talk about the knowledge polity. And I also want to talk about a little bit about the idea of the academy, the sort of mythological idea of the ivory tower, shall we say, and the reality of it. I recently talked to two authors of an edited book called The Wives of Western Philosophy. And one of their points is that the concept of the individual scholar sitting at home or in their office creating knowledge is something we all sort of have in our imaginary spaces. But as we all know, that's really not how it works. and so I'd love for you to explain what you mean by the knowledge polity and to some degree, what contributes to it.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Amerika. I mean, so we had started from a point of, you know, thinking about, you hear a lot of discussion about, you know, the pipeline of projects, right? And so kind of having a number of things going, and that was also, you know, incidentally, right, kind of things that we were thinking about when we wanted to collect that information on the lifespan of a particular project. But as we started thinking about kind of like conversations about the pipeline, the academic pipeline, we started to think that like, okay, well, this is useful, but it isn't probably like the way that we should be thinking about this. And so we started to discuss, you know, metaphors or frameworks or however you want to think about this, right? For capturing academe and all the different components of academe. And we also, right, wanted to put something in place that we thought was kind of an important statement about what makes all of this go. And that's kind of where we ended up, and perhaps no surprise, three political scientists coming up with the knowledge polity, right? like in a time when institutions are under attack, you know, like here we go, okay. But we were, you know, thinking about a system where people have kind of rights and responsibilities. And that's where we kind of, you know, kept coming back to the, something like what we ended up with the knowledge polity. We wanted to think about this as a system. And as you kind of mentioned a second ago, Lily, right, with knowledge, right, in our office, but the limitations of that idea, we wanted to kind of push us from me to we, right, to think about kind of, and perhaps again, no surprise, network scholars thinking about interconnection, interrelationship, right? But that idea of kind of like, well, what is the sense of community that we are in, right? What are responsibilities to others? Because those are locked into big parts of what we do, teaching, mentorship, reviewing behavior, all of those things, right? So we wanted to kind of stress that, you know, from me to we angle, and therefore we're all in this together. And there are things that we do by ourselves, and there are rights that come with this, right? But there are also these kinds of, if you will, responsibilities or civic duties that come with being a member of the knowledge polity. And that was a big kind of push. We thought that was a good fit for all of the different types of activities that are involved in academe.
Anybody else want to chime in? Okay, let's move on. Obviously, the outcome of your survey and your analysis is, you know, incredibly interesting and compelling. And as I said to you all before I got on, this book is really like a lively conversation and certainly not a dry social science book. And so I really enjoyed that. But you also talk about the fact that you had some disagreements in terms of what you concluded from the data that you found. So I'd love for all of you to talk about first what the outcomes were that you all saw as you were sort of analyzing the data and what came out of it, and also some of the points of disagreement.
Oh, fun. Yeah, so first of all, I'm really glad to hear you say, Lily, that you hear our argument in the book. We worked hard actually to write that argument into the book. We wanted it to feel like a conversation because we really are three people with very distinctive voices and personalities. And I would say that, you know, as I was reading Paul's text often, I would be like, no, this is wrong. or not so much, you know, we rarely disagreed about data analysis, though, you know, we did occasionally have disagreements about data analysis, which we resolved in professional, respectful ways that ultimately were better. But the bigger agreements were, or disagreements were, what does the data mean? What story can you read into this? How far can you take the interpretation of these data? So I would say, to take one example, of a place where there were some disagreements initially about how to analyze the data, but then ultimately bigger disagreements about what it all means, was the what to make of gaps, how to analyze gaps in productivity in submissions and publications, and then how to interpret them. It's clear there are some both gender and race gaps in productivity, where over a lifetime, for instance, women produce somewhat fewer articles than do men. Over a lifetime also, Black and Latinx scholars tend to produce somewhat fewer articles and other kinds of publications than do white scholars. But these gaps are not perfectly consistent across all cohorts. They're not perfectly consistent across all age cohorts. They're not necessarily perfectly consistent across the academic lifespan. And of course, as anybody who does this kind of quantitative research knows, distinguishing what's a life course effect or generational effect from a generational effect or a time effect is really hard to figure out. Are these gaps going to just disappear over time, or are there persistent barriers that are causing these to appear? All of these questions were things that, you know, take careful, really, really careful data analysis and digging in, and multiple measures of the dependent variable of the general dependent variable to try to get more specifically at what's happening. So there was lots and lots of going back to the drawing board. Let's find more data. Let's download lifetime scores on Google Scholar and things like that to try to tease out further what's happening here, and some disagreements about exciting things like interaction terms, which I'm not going to go into on this podcast. But how do you, you know, run interaction terms and these kinds of models looking at different intersectional groups? So there were some, you know, lots of empirical methodological exploration, trying to figure out what was happening, and then to try to explain it in the end, what would we say about gaps. And I think we came down in the end, ultimately, I think we all actually end up agreeing for the most part that gaps are small and inconsistent and still there. And there's a question about to what extent will they just disappear over time as things change or not. And then I would say there were gap questions about things like differences in teaching loads. So we found, for instance, that there were differences in teaching loads by gender, by race, where, for instance, some women have, there are particular points in the academic life course that women are teaching less than men, seems likely to be related to childbearing years, but how to talk about that, how to understand it, questions like that were ones that led to really active discussions, sometimes, you know, like bordering on arguments, civil ones, but arguments among us as we were trying to understand what was going on. Anand says sort of civil.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I felt like the peacemaker sometimes, you know, like, yeah,
yeah.
There were definitely, they were. Amy Emmerich's right. But yeah, they were heated. They were definitely heated. Yeah.
So. Well, because it feels real and it's about us. And, you know, it also bears on potential policy, you know, policy adoptions, policy directions that, again, would affect us and our careers. So, I mean, they were intense, but they were civil, but definitely intense. And we went to the data. I mean, and this is something I really appreciated, is that, you know, even if we had our own sort of beliefs and really strong feelings about this, I mean, we went to the data and we worked, you know, as hard as we could and tried a whole variety of ways of thinking about things. And I agree. I think we agree at the end that tentatively, right, that there are some small and inconsistent gaps that probably accrue over time, or at least, you know, probably better to put it this way. Older faculty have larger gaps than younger faculty do. And so we can't quite tell, right, if the younger, you know, assistant professors are, and when we run out their careers, are going to look like today's full professors. And, you know, of course, we seriously doubt it, right, because there's huge changes in the disciplines and Me Too and all kinds of things that would shift this. So yeah, I mean, the thing that I pushed for, the big disagreement initially was, you know, can we just control for rank and then look at gender gaps, or do we need to do interaction terms and look at those gaps within rank? From my perspective, most of those gaps went away when you looked by rank, not totally, but they definitely shrank. And that's largely where we ended up, except then that's when we added the lifetime examination. And that's where we started to see these gaps growing across time. And so that's, you know, that's a really important puzzle that we need to keep watching across time. I don't necessarily want to do another survey like this. It was a ton of work, but somebody should take this up. And then more than just, more than just scraping data. I think we actually need the survey data to dig into why. I think Amy Erica hit exactly what we're disagreeing about and how we resolved it.
Yeah, I think that there or are a number of it. Right.
Sorry.
Right.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. In some sense,
but
we
think that one
it.
Of the things that.
No, go ahead. Sorry. On.
I mean. No, it's okay. One of the things that I think emerged from those conversations, and you were alluding to this, Amy Erica and Paul, is that we're pretty upfront about what we can't say, right, in the book. And I think that's a good place to be, right? I think there's a dose of humility in the narrative that we pushed each other towards, which is a good thing. We had a number of arguments based on the analysis, right, and the data about, you know, what stories are consistent with the findings, right, and what aren't. And, you know, we were having arguments over potential things that are probably all consistent with what, you know, what we see. But there are some things we just can't answer definitively. And it was helpful for us to, you know, put clear boundaries around those and then point people towards further exploration of them.
And yeah. So I did, go ahead, Amy Erica.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I think the multivocality of it was nice. And that, I mean, the fact that we disagreed about the interpretation pushed the data analysis to go a lot farther. because we just kept going back to the drawing board for more data when we disagreed about things. And including one thing that we actually none of us have mentioned so far is qualitative data as well. We sort of topped it off with some qualitative interviews in order to try to further tease out things that we just weren't going to be able to talk about from our quantitative data. And so we kept going back for more information when we couldn't resolve debates. And I think some of these are things that I think it's great that we aren't going to be able to resolve in this book. And we're very clear about this. We're clear about multiple interpretations. And ultimately, yeah, we need more data. And these are things that are the discipline's going to academia in general, the social sciences in general, both sociology and political science, are going to continue to struggle with for a while.
And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about the sort of different kinds of the data itself, the qualitative data, as you've been talking a lot about it, but you lead off in lots of places with the quotes that you got from interviews. And so there's this integration, and you note that it was not quite a random sample of people, and you wanted to make sure that there were differences represented, and it was a small group of people who you interviewed for the book. But can you talk a little bit about integrating that, the sort of commentary and interviews, into this big survey that you had done?
Anand, would you like to take that?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Amy, Erica. Yeah, so one of the things that occurred to us right after we had spent some time with the survey data was we, in some of these conversations about what the results meant and how people were answering them, we started to kind of think about the questions that we didn't ask, right? And so, and then also, okay, so what might be kind of going on with the ways that people are approaching this? What dimensions of experience are we missing and so forth? And then it occurred to us that, you know, what would be really, you know, helpful here would be to sit down and have in-depth conversations with people around these different topics to flesh out our understanding of the quantitative analysis. And so, yeah, what we did was we tried to get interviews with people in varying types of institutions, with varying types of ranks, positions, right, including administrative experience, and then racial and gender diversity as well. And we wanted to have long conversations with these folks. And these conversations were, I think, on average an hour, right? So they were lengthy, and they were structured, right? We had kind of a list of questions, but they were also kind of like free flowing. We really wanted to kind of let people talk and hear about kind of what they had to say when we brought up different topics, and then also kind of like, you know, brought in findings that we had, and kind of bounced those two off each other. And that kind of way of collecting the interview data, I think, also translates really kind of, you know, directly into what you talked about, Lily, with like, well, how did you integrate the two? And so what we did was we kind of took the interview data that we gathered from that, and we kind of worked it into, you know, these different analyses. We had been thinking about those places where we needed additional information as we collected the qualitative interviews, right? And so it was kind of nice for us to be able to kind of triangulate and situate that stuff. And then it also, I think, helps with the flow in the narrative, right? To kind of keep us moving and introduce different topics and translate those things from a survey context into natural language and back and forth.
The other thing we did is, I mean, we're all on Twitter, more or less. And so just constantly noting, oh, that's really interesting. they're doing exactly what we're talking about in chapter whatever. Let's grab that tweet. So yeah, we're kind of doing those on the fly kind of observations as well.
Yes, there's a lot of this kind of chatter on academic Twitter. so I'm sure you found lots of examples.
that was also the motivation though, right? I mean, there's just so much blather and, you know, people like from Harvard talking about their experiences as if everybody goes through that. And we're like, no. And that's actually been, you know, one of our jobs is we sort of swoop in knowledge polity here and we actually have data on that. I'm sure we're annoying, but I think it's nice to have some data to qualify or contextualize what people are saying.
Yeah. And again, that's also, you know, one of my experiences. It's like, yeah, we're not all at an Ivy League on the East Coast with very deep pockets.
Yeah. I would say that one of the things that's just super interesting about this, about our data is looking at distributions. I mean, we have a number of places where histograms play an exciting role in our book. I'm not sure if I've ever said that word before, that phrase before. Histograms play an exciting role, but really, histograms. I mean, just looking at distributions across academia of things like teaching loads, reviewing load. Startup funding. Well, actually, we don't look at startup funding. We bring in research by Jane Lawrence Sumner and Ellen Key on startup funding. All sorts of resources available for professors. It's just super time spent on research. Super interesting to see the dramatic variation across the professoriate.
One thing I love to drop into academic Twitter is, you know, everybody complains, oh, I'm so overburdened with reviews. I have so many to do. I have six on my desktop or whatever. And then I swoop in and say, the average is four a year. And they're like, oh, you know, like settle down, everybody. You know, most people aren't doing that much. Don't get too freaked out. So.
I wanted to ask you about, you know, this is always sometimes a fun question for researchers, and particularly when you pull together a big survey and you run it, what was surprising in terms of the outcomes? What did you kind of expect? And then what did you get that was perhaps unexpected?
Paul, you want to take this?
Yeah, sure. It's a lot to think about. In some ways, there were so many things that were interesting. I guess, you know, one of the like sort of broad relationships that I thought was interesting is how much personality seemed to play a role and sort of attitudes about the review process, especially because we're all socialized in such a similar sort of way that to see some of those things pop. We're really interesting, and we could talk more about that. I just figured that that productivity might grow over time as you know, you get lower teaching loads and other things. But productivity was essentially the same across rank, which I thought was really interesting. We complain about, you know, how few people do reviews and how, you know, people are shirking their duties and that sort of thing. But our analysis actually shows that most people are meeting their reviewer debts, which I was surprised to see, especially, you know, given the complaints on academic Twitter. That's a few. Let my colleagues here talk about some of their own. Anand, you want to jump in, and then Amy, Erica?
Yeah, thanks, Paul. As Paul kind of noted, there are many findings in the book. You noted this too, Lily, but just kind of running through a few of my favorites that I think are, you know, really interesting. When we're kind of looking at, like, you know, first of all, I thought it was really kind of just interesting and cool that we were able to kind of look at, you know, kind of work-life balance in a really systematic way. And we break that down, you know, in chapter three of our book and elsewhere. And those findings I just find incredibly interesting. In the networks chapter, one thing that I think is interesting and that also is something we need to keep working on, is that, you know, we had published a piece in PS that was kind of looking at the returns that male and female identifying scholars get on their co-authorships in terms of submissions and publications. And we had found that, you know, there seemed to be kind of like a differential kind of return on investment, if you will, for female identifying scholars in the discipline, that they were getting lower returns on co-authorship. One of the interesting things that came out of our subsequent work as we were kind of like building on that and then doing analysis for the book is that we found that those kinds of differential returns were really more limited to people who primarily work in quantitative methodology, right? So those some of those network stories that we found and then our next iteration seemed to be kind of more conditional on quantitative, qualitative divides. So one of the things that I think is a call for our colleagues to continue working on is trying to figure out what might be some of those differences among male and female identifying, social scientists who are doing, primarily quantitative work. What is it about those networks, perhaps, right, that is kind of producing these different returns? So that was something that was interesting and surprising and kind of built off our previous work. And then the last thing I'll say, and I'll turn it over to Amy Erica, is as Paul kind of noted, I find, you know, the personality work that we got into really interesting. And the particular interplay between openness and conscientiousness is just, I think, very cool. It's something I've been talking to people about when they'll indulge me to talk about the book. but kind of where, you know, for scholars where one of these things picks up for the other. And we kind of see, you know, this, if you will, right, like that, you know, oftentimes, you know, people who are, you know, high in openness, you know, they can draw on others, right, who are conscientious, and it kind of helps work get out the door and so forth, right? So kind of that balance between that we see between, you know, collaboration and personality, I think is really interesting and something that, you know, I wouldn't have thought about before we kind of got into it. Amy Erica?
Okay, yeah, so, I don't know, they've stolen a lot of mine already.
I'm sorry.
I would say, building on what Anand was talking about, another thing that stands out really strongly in our data is the incredible importance of co-authorship. That co-authorship just works way, way, way better than single authorship in terms of getting research to publication. And that co-authorship often makes up for personality. So personality, to be honest, from my perspective, the personality variables really pop out pretty strongly as important drivers of productivity in our data. But co-authorship reduces the impact of individual personality, which is intuitive. You can easily come up with a story for how this would work. But it's important to say that basically having a good co-author makes up a lot for not being very conscientious yourself. So getting into good co-authorship relationships, I think, can really help in terms of academic productivity. And I'm sure it also reduces all kinds of other sort of psychological issues related to publication, things like anxiety and that kind of thing. I would also say, again, as before, the tremendous distribution of lots of things like teaching loads. I think many of us have some general sense of the distribution of teaching loads, but seeing it in a histogram makes it really very stark. Ability to spend time on research, desire probably, though we don't measure desire, to spend time on research, all kinds of things vary tremendously across the professoriate. I would say another thing that was kind of a surprise to us, we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the differences between poli-sci and soc, in large part because the two disciplines are really very similar So we started off with a book that was going to be about differences between poli-sci and soci, and ended up not writing that book because disciplinary differences really largely washed out. They were small, inconsistent, mostly. I mean, we would have written a book about a bunch of null findings if we had continued to emphasize the differences between poli-sci and soci. It's not clear, because we don't have enough data from other social science disciplines, whether other social sciences are also really similar to poli-sci and soci. But at least these two disciplines look like remarkably similar. Even, you know, I'm talking about these histograms of distributions, and yet if you look at the histograms for poli-sci and soci, they're often almost identical. So the differences are between individuals within various kinds of institutions, and the discipline that somebody's in really has very little impact.
So you all are very upfront in the preface to the book about the fact that there is a need for more research and continuing research in this area, even though you have a lot of really fascinating findings and you are able to pull together a lot of data. And so what I wanted to ask you about in sort of concluding the conversation about this amazing book, The Knowledge Polity, is what does need to happen next? Where are the research streams and who or what should be the questions that follow to continue the research?
Okay, so quickly, the one thing that needs, where we need a lot further research, is what we've already alluded to, that we can document gaps. And we can say a lot about the gaps because we have spent so much time plowing through the data to really try to understand what's going on. Are you all able to hear me?
We can't hear anything you're saying.
Oh, I can hear it.
Oh, you can? Oh, I couldn't hear anything she's saying.
I can't hear it either. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, sorry for saying that then.
It's okay. Me too.
All right. Okay, so I'm going to just keep talking then. I'll start from the beginning. Okay, to answer your question quickly, Lily, one of the things that that needs to happen is, as we've already alluded to, we can say a lot about the gaps that exist. We have lots and lots of data on gaps, and we can tell the story about racial and gender gaps in a pretty nuanced way in the data. But ultimately, we can't fully explain them, neither in the quantitative nor the qualitative data. We can't explain why they have happened. We can't say explain them away. There needs to be a lot more research on these issues. The other thing that I would say is that we need that the future keeps changing. So academia continues to evolve. We continue to have, we have changes in the nature of the professoriate, changes in academic work structures. And so we need further work. For instance, we can't say much about how academia is recovering from COVID-19 pandemic. It's clear that the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted much of academia, but we can't say anything. We can say something about what it looks like from the middle of the pandemic. We can't really say something say much about how academics are recovering in a late pandemic or post-pandemic world.
So I'd ask Anand to sort of voice some of his ideas about what we should be looking forward to in terms of continued research in this area, beyond as sort of explaining, trying to explain the gaps, because as Amy Erica notes, the gaps are there, and you did a really good job of sort of fleshing them out. But it's really hard to sort of explain the gaps.
Yeah. Thanks, Lily. And thanks, Amy Erica. Yeah. So I think that some other things that I would love to see people kind of pick up and run with is, you know, we talked before about co-authorship and the importance of co-authorship. And you know, by necessity, we could only get, you know, kind of people's core co-authorship networks in this study. And so I think it would be really interesting for people to do some work that kind of looks at broader patterns of interaction and collaboration and feedback from people. So getting kind of beyond that core network and trying to understand a little bit more about the socially embedded nature of academe, right? Because in a lot of ways, this book is about the fact that very little of what we do is truly in isolation. You know, we are in networks and we are in institutions and so forth. And another thing that that I think is important that Amy Erica alluded to is, you know, trying to kind of figure out, right, the lasting effects of the pandemic and how these things are going to interface with things like our collaborative networks, our peers, our feedback, you know, our patterns of feedback that we get from others, the interruptions that have been caused by not having conferences in many circumstances for a couple of years. So we think it would be, you know, it'd be really interesting for people to kind of pick that up and help us kind of understand, you know, how all of the things that we kind of set up and study have worked through this period that we're kind of hopefully coming out of, right? And are going to be there going forward.
And Paul, what would you like to see in terms of the follow-on to the research that the three of you have done?
Sure. Yeah. One of the sort of frustrating things that we wanted to deal with, sort of nagging questions for the gaps, and maybe Amy Erica already talked about this, was the content of what people study and how that content, the questions that they ask, is linked to things like journal space and treatment in journals, and that's treatment by reviewers as well. So we just don't really, we weren't able to do that. And we tried asking a little bit about the content of what they study, but not in any kind of sufficient depth. And just, it's just one little nugget that still sticks in my craw a little bit. When we look at sociology, is that they tend to have six issues, of their journals, a year. And we typically have four in political science, and it shows up in the data. So they have, they're less stressed about the review process. They submit fewer articles, but they publish more than we do. They take longer to develop projects. I mean, everything just seems so much more relaxed in sociology than it does in political science. And so, I mean, that's a big broad one. But what if this kind of thing is playing out in, you know, the study of racial politics versus gender versus, you know, religion and politics and whatever. I mean, I know religion and politics scholars, the world improved immensely once we had a journal attached to the APSIS section. So anyway, thinking about, you know, how questions connect to institutional resources and then treatment would be really fascinating and I think really important.
Yeah, and I've often seen some in interesting analysis about the kind of content. If you are a Black man studying racial politics, and whether or not that gets published as opposed to, say, a Black man studying elections, and those understandings of the content. And I know those of us in political theory have some of these same questions as well, since political theory also seems to be still kind of lagging behind in gender representation across the board, as opposed to our colleagues in the rest of the discipline. So I wanted to thank Paul Jupe, Amy Erica Smith, and Anand Edward Soki for joining me today to talk about The Knowledge Polity, Teaching and Research in the Social Sciences. This is published in 2022 by Oxford University Press, and it is actually a propulsive read. So I recommend it to listeners who are looking for some information about political science, sociology, social sciences, race, and the academy and gender in the academy. And you will love reading it because it is a joy to read. So does anybody want to give a shout out to any brick and mortar stores where one might be able to purchase or order the book?
Yeah, actually, I'd love to give a shout out to Dog-Eared Books, which is a great name. They also have a store mascot who is a dog. they have a golden retriever, lovely golden retriever. Anyway, so Dog-Eared Books in Ames, Iowa. You can buy it from Dog-Eared Books. You can call them up. You can find Dog-Eared Books by Googling Dog-Eared Books, or you can go to dogeareduxames.com. They also have an online ordering service through bookshop.com or .org. Bookshop.org. But yeah, you can just
really quick. I'll just point out, Bookloft.com. It's a great bookstore in Columbus, Ohio. Anna?
I think these guys have it covered.
All right, great. Thank you all for joining me today and talking about the Knowledge Polity.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Lily.
Thank you, Lily. This was fantastic. I really appreciate it.